welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, April 26, 2024. I'm your host, Breanne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble editor Nick Seabrook sits down with Alex Stratus from Climate Justice U Ottawa to talk about the work they do fighting for climate justice on and off campus. Climate Justice U Ottawa is a student-run, grassroots organization aimed at achieving climate justice within the U Ottawa community and beyond. Their mission includes encouraging universities to fully divest from organizations which fund fossil fuel projects. Alex Stratus is a third-year political science and communication student at the University of Ottawa, with experience in advocating and organizing grassroots campaigns on the climate crisis through her work as co-president of Climate Justice U Ottawa. Here are Nick Seabrook and Alex Stratus in conversation. Take a listen.
So, thank you, Alex, for joining us.
Oh my gosh, yeah, of course. Thank you for having me.
First, tell me a little bit about what Climate Justice at University of Ottawa is and what it does.
Ooh, okay. So Climate Justice is a club that used to primarily focus on divestment with the University of Ottawa, getting the University of Ottawa to divest from direct and indirect holdings with fossil fuels. So that was a huge campaign that we had, and we were successful actually in getting the university to divest. So now we're moving on to the RBC off-campus focus and trying to get RBC off our campus, as implied in the title. And we're also into, as well, we participate a lot in protests and sit-ins with Indigenous groups on campus and anything in concern, really, with getting direct fossil fuel investments off campus and indirect fossil fuel investments off campus is also what we do. It's a lot of protesting. It's a lot of organizing. We also work with like local counselors and groups such as Change Course, Greenpeace, Climate Fridays for Futures as well. It's a good time.
Awesome. And before we get into a little bit more of that work, could you tell me a little bit about yourself and what made you want to get involved with this group?
Yeah. So I am a third-year student at the University of Ottawa taking political science and communications. But I'm co-president now at Climate Justice, but I was a member there for a year and then I became co-president. So this is my second year. And what got me into the club actually was I was like trying out different clubs. I was trying to see what I liked and what I was looking for. I was trying to see a community of people that I really enjoyed. And I kind of stumbled onto a tabling for Climate Justice. I was like, I really like these people. These guys are onto something. And then I joined and it's been great since. Then I went to my first protest, you know, and your first like little sit-in and did some speeches. And I'm like, I am having the time of my life here.
Fantastic. And why is the issue of climate change important to you?
Honestly, it's I love the interconnectivity of climate change because it honestly touches every aspect, every study that I look into. Especially, I've always had a focus and a deep concern with Indigenous rights and rights for people of color and how they suffer, and the interrogation and this interesting aspect of how space and how land is constantly in the question of the colonizer, constantly in the mind of the colonizer as well, and how important it is and the traditions we have connected to the land. That's always been such a huge interest for me. And obviously climate change is a man-made, it's part of the Anthropocene, right? Something that industrialization has produced, something that colonization has help propel. So it's always come down to through solving climate change, we can push for the decolonization. So,
and on the issue of climate change, you know, we hear a lot of doom and gloom. There's a lot of urgency around the issue. Is anxiety around climate change something that you experienced? And was that something that maybe encouraged you to join this group?
Yeah, anxiety is a huge problem we have, especially amongst our group, because Well, not only that, you have people telling you this will never work, the external and the internal, you're kind of fighting with these forces. Because, you know, you look into the news and you have to continuously be active when you're a climate activist, when you're an activist in general, and see what's happening. And it's very hard. It can be very hard to combat this climate gloom. It can be very hard to dig through. And the only way I found that you can is through community. It's through the fact that I have, like, my best friend is the co-president of this club as well. So it's the fact that I also have my best friend here and we're in this together and we just keep on going. We just like keep tunneling through. And that's really the best you can do, and continuously educate yourself, because we also believe like this negativity, it's part of trying to make us apathetic so we can no longer be a part of the cause, which is a tool. Apathy is such a powerful tool. So we constantly try to educate ourselves. We constantly try to like build community together to try to get through.
Now, just getting to your recent protests related to the Royal Bank of Canada, RBC. Now, RBC is the largest financier of the fossil fuel industry in Canada. Globally, it ranks fifth. So it has a massive impact on this issue. Can you tell me a little bit about what these on-campus branches are and how you've been protesting around them?
Yeah, so on campus, they, for Uwatawa specifically, the RBC branch is extremely new. It's only been here since COVID. It was built during COVID when no one was there to protest it, when no one was there to like speak, no students were there to speak against it. It used to be a student study space. And then there are also so few study spaces on campus. Everyone always complains about it. Like, it's a huge problem. And then they got rid of it and put the RBC branch. And that was not the plan. So now we're here and we're protesting around it. And it's a bit of a task. We've had some problems with the branch manager and we've had some problems with some of the employees, but campus security has been pretty accommodating, actually. Honestly, they kind of get it now. but it's a lot of like sitting in. It's a lot of doing collaborations with Indigenous groups on campus. We also did one with INSAF, which is the Palestinian group on campus. And we tied that in. And and the student union is on board as well. So it's really about pulling in and creating a coalition with different groups on campus and having our sit-ins or having our protests or even just having flyers to hand out to educate people on campus just to get the word out.
And when you mentioned sit-ins, that involves physically occupying the RBC branch space for a time. When was the last time you did that?
I believe it was in February, March, was when we did that. It was for the morning. And yeah, we occupied the space, and it went really successfully. We did chants. We had signs. Once again, it was with the Palestinian activist group on campus at UOttawa, which was INSAF. And we had our chants more specifically geared to like divestment. So not another nickel, not another dime, no more money for Israel's crimes and stuff like that. And we also sang some songs. It was actually a really nice protest. It went really well.
Now, you've mentioned your partnership with the Palestinian student group at the University of Ottawa. And obviously, you know, you're connecting this with the ongoing situation in Gaza. Why was it important to create that solidarity with the Palestinian student group and encompass the larger Israel issue with the issue of climate change?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, the movement for divestment, it's because we understand that money is the name of the game, right? So if we take out RBC, if we protest against the sources of these things, which is money, such as RBC, such as that has shares in Palantir, or, you know, you have people boycotting as well for Palestine, against Israel, and like for Starbucks, for McDonald's, and et cetera. It's because we understand that money drives this world. And by pulling people in from Palestine, for example, where we see sources of RBC funding into Palantir, RBC funding into these things that destroy and that perpetuate these colonial forces that are oppressing, you know, that are oppressing us. We tie them in so easily. It's an incredible thing being able to collaborate with situations where people are like, why are you protesting with with the Palestinian group? Why are you protesting with these groups? Because we're all tied at the very end of the day with land and money. So we were able to pull it very, very easily. They were very kind with us.
Now, you mentioned Palantir. For our listeners who aren't aware of what that is, could you explain a little bit about what Palantir is and how it's connected to RBC?
Yeah, so Palantir is a company that produces AI imaging and helps create AI profiles for the Israeli military to help them more easily identify Palestinians and create profiles against literally any Palestinian. You could post something on Facebook about someone you love who died at the hands of an IDF soldier, and they will mark that and they'll put that in a profile for a Palestinian, give that as an excuse for them to arrest them. There's plenty of amazing articles written on it, but the whole point of it is so they could do preemptive arrests, and then they put them in jail for months at a time without representation. And it's just, it's like, it's an abuse of power, right? That's just the reality of it.
And RBC's a heavy investor in Palantir.
Yeah. They have a lot of stock in Palantir.
For your protests against RBC on both of these issues, you know, you mentioned earlier a little bit about negative reaction from staff at the branch, from the branch manager. Has there been any direct communication to you from RBC about your protests?
Yes, we had a meeting with RBC executives, actually. VP John Stackhouse was there. Andrew Block was there. I believe that's his name, who is like the PR representative for the climate branch for RBC. He's on that. And there was the branch manager as well. There was a whole line of people on the other side of the table. There were like 10 people. But honestly, it was a conversation between the student, between us and VP John Stackhouse. And yeah, we had a conversation about why we don't want them on our campus, why we would prefer them to actually simply, we would like them to, their holdings are unequitable, why we would not like, we don't like them because of their climate injustices and the fact that they invest so much in their clients and their Athabasca tar sands and et cetera, the LNG pipeline, et cetera. And we had a very enlightening conversation. We let them know, actually, the way we've been treated. This is a news article written by the Fulcrum somewhere, which is the Ubatuan News paper, but like one of our protestees were called names and stuff like that by the branch manager. They try to call the police on us a lot of times, which is not what you should be doing when you have some protesters. We were literally giving out pamphlets and they tried to get the police in on it. They had the police email us and et cetera, which was pretty inappropriate. Appropriate behavior for handing out pamphlets and popcorn, if I must say. And often when we're having sit-ins and stuff, they try to call police, but often campus police doesn't like it when they call police because it's a campus police issue. So campus police will try to intervene and stop them from calling police. Or when police does arrive, they're there, they're like, okay, cool. Like, why are we here? This is kind of an issue for campus police. Or campus security. So there's a bit of an over-policing issue. I did find, though, after the conversation we did have with VP John Stackhouse, like they trusted more campus police, campus security to take on the issues. I don't know if there was a conversation then between the branch manager and them, but yeah, they said they wanted to take stark measures for the security of their branch, of their, the people that work at their branch, even though there's never really been a, there hasn't been a history of us being any means aggressive towards them. It was a long conversation. It was only an hour of the conversation we had. So we had a lot to cover in very small, short period of time.
And what was the reaction from these RBC executives when you said that you wanted them to divest from the fossil fuel industry or get off campus? Do they show any sort of interest in divesting from fossil fuels?
They had, no, they used a tactic of like, because they still want to stay in the game, right? But they knew that we were students, so they were trying to like sugarcoat it a bit. But isn't like what they said, the grand gist of what they were saying is we're obviously not leaving fossil fuels, but here's some lovely things we've been doing, like the Pathways Alliance, or like the or they were talking about like this other project they were helping with agriculture and this blah blah blah. And it's like they were trying to kind of redirect us a lot, kind of gently, like gentle parenting us into seeing, Oh, but here we do carbon credits, and we know that carbon credits aren't like anything. Like, just because like you drove this many kilometers and put this much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and then you grow a tree, that doesn't really, that's not really the problem here. Like, you know, things like that. And they tried to, a lot to question our knowledge as well on the matter. But that was what was expected. We also didn't expect going into the meeting for anything to actually change, but we wanted them to know that this is our dissent, this is our problem, and we're definitely not going to stop, even if you keep redirecting us to these ridiculous initiatives that you have.
So, any indication, though, that they would even concede to divesting themselves from campus and remove their branch?
Oh, no, definitely not. No. Sorry, I feel like that was very. Like, but that was definitely not on their minds. I think they're gonna stay in there until as long as they possibly can. And that's just the reality of the situation. That's fine. We'll continue.
Now, you had mentioned earlier in our conversation that climate justice at the University of Ottawa had been successful in other instances of encouraging the university to divest from fossil fuels. So, does that give you hope that you can win this fight with RBC?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It gives us a lot of hope that we have actually a lot of allies within the administration, maybe not in the leaders themselves, but within the administration who look at us, who smile, who forward our emails to the people that really should be seeing our emails, who tell us, hey, maybe you should look into this report that's going to come out in March, or hey, you should be looking into these things, who really help us nudge forward. It's very encouraging to see that. And they like to see our success, and that's very, very lovely to hear.
Awesome. And I was actually going to ask you about faculty because, we're seeing right now, especially in the States at Columbia University in New York City, faculty allying themselves with students who are protesting against the violence Israel is perpetrating in Gaza. Have you experienced a lot of support from faculty at your university on this issue?
Faculty themselves, it's honestly been because I find universities are very like the professors, as I don't know if this is just specific to Ottawa, they're very individual. They don't have that much community. So one professor could be absolutely on your side completely, and the other could be furthest from it. And it's an enormous spectrum. It's not really like a huge community, but they don't honestly. I'd like to say that like faculty doesn't engage with us as much as I'd like them to. You maybe might see one or two professors who might show up to an event with a kaffiyeh, but they seem to they're not as engaging with the student community as I would actually like them to.
Yeah, now for university administration itself, technically they are in charge of the campus. Have you asked them to consider removing RBC from campus?
Yeah, we have. We work a lot with the student union actually does push into, they have meetings, regular meetings with these admin and these people, and they have those conversations a lot, and they don't seem that interested in getting RBC off campus. And that's kind of because it's a big bother for them. It's a big like loss for them as well financially. So it's they're not usually for it, but you have some people within like the sustainability center, these little like green centers that are like, yeah, we're with you.
Now, I know that your university isn't the only one engaged in this issue. RBC has on-campus branches at other universities across the country, University of British Columbia, University of Toronto, and there are similar student groups on these campuses engaged in similar activism as your group. Has there been any contact between you and those other groups, any sort of coordination?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually, that day of that action we had in March, with the Palestinian group was part of a wider day of action, helped funneled via Change Course, which is another huge grassroots organization that connects all these student groups across Canada that advocate for divestment from RBC on their campus. So it's really a pleasure to have. We have like pretty regular meetings across the board with all of the leaders across Canada, in these groups, and we do have conversation. We do have, hey, maybe on this day we should have this, and it is coordinated. Yeah.
For your group at the University of Ottawa, what's next? I know you're coming close to the end of your semester, but what are future plans to continue to stay active on this issue?
Future plans to continue to stay active on this issue do include a lot of things. We actually have fossil-free research which is something we are looking into right now, is the campaign we're launching. It's pretty new, but it's looking into how like scholarship is affected by the funding from fossil fuel communities, from fossil fuel shareholders and entities, and how the scholarship is affected via from it. So that's a huge initiative that we're starting right now. We're also looking into improving like our community, like clubs around us and different like student faculty groups to get them to stop banking with RBC and to bank with a credit union or even Desjardins and stuff like that as well. That's what we're looking forward to in the new year. And more protesting, more on the ground activism, and simply just growing more awareness and community within the university.
You know, what's next for you? You mentioned you're a political science student in your third year. Do you think that once you graduate and you get into your career and later in life, that activism like this is something that's going to stay with you?
Oh, yeah. I think it's a bit of an addiction. I know activism scares people, actually. I don't know why. It's a great time because you meet so many incredible people while you're continuing this work. And at the very core of it, I'm going to continue my activism, whether it's through reading, whether it's through education, et cetera. But at the very end of it, like groundwork, like the direct actions you do, being a body that is occupying physical space in a place that they don't want you there, in a place that obstructs their wants and stops them from doing what they want to continue perpetuating, that is such an essential part of being an activist, of being someone who's constantly against others. And I absolutely need to live there because it makes me uncomfortable and I need that, you know?
All right. Very well said. Alex Stratus, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Oh my gosh, a pleasure.
Was Alex Stratus from Climate Justice U Ottawa in conversation with Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Thanks so much for that, Alex and Nick. Switching gears now, let's review the top stories on Rabble.ca in a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, let's turn things back over to Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in national news. The advocacy group Council of Canadians is calling out federal Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre for his disingenuous stance on the housing crisis in Canada. While Poilievre places blame on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, so-called gatekeepers, and even international students, the Council of Canadians argues that he's ignoring the real culprits for the lack of affordable housing. According to the Council, the lack of affordable housing can directly be tied to speculators, investors, and real estate developers, all of whom are profiting greatly from the crisis. The Council points to the fact that half of all the condominium units built in the Greater Toronto area over the past 2 years have been bought by speculators. They say that the reason that Poilievre ignores this fact is because he has industry lobbyists on his staff and developers as his donors. John Cartwright writes, quote, "We need to start shining a light on the unspoken words at the root of the housing crisis and call for solutions that will make affordability real instead of just a slogan," end quote. In labor news, the Alberta Union of Public Employees is accusing the province's finance minister, Nate Horner, of bargaining through the press. Horner publicly balked at the union's request for a wage increase that keeps up with the rate of inflation in the province. Over the past 7 years, the government employees represented by the union have received a wage increase of just 3.8%. Meanwhile, the rate of inflation in Alberta sits at over 6%. The Alberta Union of Public Employees represents workers who work in administrative support and program services, law enforcement roles, trades, natural resources and conservation, social services, health and support services, and technical services. In Ontario news, the Toronto Young Women's Christian Association, YWCA, are arguing that nonprofit organizations need better supports to recover from the damage done by Bill 124. Bill 124 was introduced in 2018 by Conservative Premier Doug Ford and capped compensation increases for public sector workers at just 1% per year. While Bill 124 was overturned by the courts, nonprofit organizations like the YWCA are struggling to catch up and pay their workers the wages they are owed. The nonprofit sector workforce is 80% women and racialized workers. The sector also saw unprecedented turnover in 2023, and the inability to provide competitive salaries is hindering the ability of these organizations to recruit, which is why the YWCA is urgently asking for support for the nonprofit sector. Staying in Ontario news. Ontario Premier Doug Ford continues to subsidize hydroelectricity rates in the province to keep them artificially low, at the expense of the long-term sustainability of the electricity market. According to the province's Financial Accountability Office, Doug Ford planned in 2022 to spend $118 billion over the next 20 years to keep electricity costs low. Ford had promised in that year's election to lower electricity costs by 12% by the next election, but it isn't working. As of 2023, according to the Financial Accountability Office, he had already spent $54 billion in an effort to keep costs down. In an op-ed for Rabble, Paul Kinnert, a former spokesperson for the Ontario Electricity Coalition, said that the reason for rising costs was due to the privatization and deregulation of Ontario Hydro. And finally, David Suzuki is warning of the dangers of drought. Around the world, temperatures are rising, and many areas, including in Canada, are becoming drier as a result. A recent University of California study showed that aquifers and other groundwater around the world were dropping. On average, aquifers included in the study dropped by 71% over the course of the study period, and this includes areas of Alberta and Saskatchewan. As we continue to fight the effects of climate change, Suzuki reminds everyone that part of that struggle is the preservation and conservation of the world's drinking water. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nierenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.